Should I just? Hi, welcome. It is my pleasure to introduce today's speaker, Professor Raymond Ng. Raymond is a professor at the Computer Science Department at University of British Columbia. He conducts research on several areas like data mining, text mining, health informatics. He has published several, over 200 papers in these areas, and his work has won several Best Paper Awards. Professor Ng is also a chief informatics officer at the Proof Center of Excellence, where he does research on genomics and biomarker discovery for organ failures. And I believe we are going to hear more about that today from Raymond. Take it away, Raymond. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much. I thank you for inviting me to come and share with you some of the work that we have been doing almost in the past 10 years. And I think for those people who might know me, they probably know me more associated with the university. And this is why I want to start off by talking a little bit more about the Proof Center. So the word proof actually stands for prevention, PR, of organ failure. So the last OF is for organ failure. And this is a not-for-profit organization that was initially established in 2008, and we got funding from the federal government of Canada to try to create a world-class center that really is trying to do translational genomics in the space of personalized medicine. And the kind of the context is something that I want to share with you in the next 10 minutes or so, and that, when you look at the amount of money that Canada spent, and remember that Canada is we have socialized medicine within Canada, and so the Canadian government actually every year would spend well over, let me convert that to U.S. dollars for you, is there were well over $60 billion every year on just three organs, the end stage conditions for heart, for lung, and for kidney. I mean, if you look at that number, and in fact, the typical way to look at the ratio between Canada and the U.S. is that Canada is typically one-tenth the size of the U.S. So if I take this number and I want to project what is the cost on heart, lung, and kidney diseases within the U.S. every year, it will be $600 billion. Huge amount of money. And this number is not even updated. I think this number is probably about 10 years old. And so I would expect that because of aging, the demographics, the number today, it's even bigger. So that's kind of the context. But what is our solution, so to speak? So our approach is creating biomarker solutions, and I just want to give a little bit of a medical textbook definition of what biomarker means. It's just some distinct biological indicators. It might be cellular, as in a tissue biopsy, biochemical, molecular. You're just trying to measure something that is indicative of a process, an event, or a condition. And now, in our case, what we are particularly focusing in on is, being a genomics organization, is we are interested in creating biomarkers in the form of blood tests. And these are tests that are going to be measuring some small number of genes and or proteins in the blood. And we use a lot of, genomics technologies in order to do that measurement. So I deliberately emphasize the word blood in this slide because I want to just right here relate back to what has that to do with the $600 billion per year figure that I was talking about earlier. Well, blood test is really cheap. a single test could be administered and the whole cost would be like $50. So if there's a lot of things that you could do with a blood test, you could in fact be able to help to reduce the cost, even from the point of view of diagnosis, from a point of view of diagnosis. Not to speak of the fact that if you could catch certain things much earlier, like what I'm going to show you next, you might, that amount of money that you could save in prevention will be even higher. So this is why I just want to connect from the, I started off with dollars and connect that to why we are interested in blood. What I'm showing in the next slide is a very simple cartoon that actually show a lot of things when it comes to chronic diseases. So what I'm showing here, the x-axis is time. So imagine that this is the age of a person. And then the y-axis is the state of health. So this might be, you know, organ function. You know, you could measure the organ function of your heart, your kidney, your lung. And so this is what the y-axis is. Well, as we age, unfortunately, the organ is going to decline. And so the blue curve is showing normal kind of aging. Unfortunately, there are people where the decline is actually faster than normal aging, which is what the yellow curve is. But worse yet, there are actually scenarios where the decline is even worse. So we call them the rapid decliners and the slow decliners. And what this slide is showing is that, you know, there are cases where if you do a lot of things towards the end, there's you know, it is not, it's very costly, it's very irreversible, and the premise of what we want to do is to be able to go earlier, higher in this curve. So there are, what I'm going to talk a little bit about, you know, 5 minutes each, is to give an example of some of the blood tests that we have been working on. In one case, it's longer than 10 years. And they are showing that, so there are early detection opportunities when it comes to using biomarkers. There are also opportunities when it comes to end stage. And I'm going to start off with an end stage example. And again, use that to see how the blood test is really very important, not just from the view of better medicine, but also from the point of view of cheaper cost. And there's also a lot of opportunities when you're using the blood test as a means to tell, to guide management of care, you know, stratification and things like that. So let me show you one scenario, which is in the end stage. So the example that this is a project that we have done for quite some time. Is biomarkers in transplantation for acute rejection. So currently, when a person really has an organ that is no longer working, really end stage, one way to help the patient is to do a transplantation. Transplanted heart, transplanted kidney, transplanted lung. Now, a lot of people, a lot of transplanted patients falsely believe that after the transplantation, everything is going to go back to normal. Okay? And in fact, that is very far away from the truth for most patients. Because one of the problems is that the body actually reacts to the transplanted organ. So this is so-called acute rejection. And the way that acute rejection is being diagnosed, right now the gold standard is to do a tissue biopsy. And what I've listed here are some of the main problems with tissue biopsy. It's very, very invasive because it's that the patients need to be sent into a surgery room in order to get the biopsy. It might not be done very timely because if you are in a remote area, you need to ship to a major city and you need to line up for the surgery room and so on. It's very expensive, etc. And so what we have been doing is we are trying to find a blood test which is minimally invasive, obviously compared with a surgery, that will allow us to diagnose acute rejection. So the example that this is the person here that that we are showing here, her name is Maxine. What happened to her was that she had a viral infection in her heart, and she faced sudden death, cardiac assist, and she ended up, she was lucky that there was actually a transplanted heart ready for her, and so she did a transplant. But the problem afterwards is what I'm talking about here is that in monitoring it to, in order to monitor, to make sure that she doesn't have acute rejection, she has to do 14 heart biopsies in the first year. 14. Okay, so this is, you know, once every 2 weeks for the first 3 months, and then once a month thereafter. It's really barbaric if you kind of think of it that way. Okay? So what we were doing is that we are trying to create a test that would at least minimize the number of times that she really need to be doing a biopsy. And then, so this is a program that we have actually started in 2004, so it's now 12 years. And the total amount of money that we have spent on this program is now, you know, if you, I mean, it's well over $10 million now. We did the discovery more than 10 years ago. We have gone through various stages of the replication, and now it's actually being tested in a real patient cohort at St. Paul's Hospital, and hopefully sometime this year, if we have collect enough data, we will try to go to the US FDA and the Health Canada, trying to get the regulatory approval. And just to come back to the point earlier about the cost, so this is much better for Maxine, but also from the point of view of healthcare costs, is that each biopsy costs at least $10,000. A blood test is $50. Okay, so that is more than two orders of magnitude difference when it comes to cost. Not to speak of the quality of life and, you know, all those things. The other point that I want to make is maybe not so much in the transplanted heart case, but because when you have a diagnostic device that is so much less expensive and so easy to administer, it also opens the possibility that you could do that diagnosis much more frequently. So instead of doing it, I mean, not so much in this case, but there are other scenarios, instead of monitoring the patient until you see an event, maybe you want to do a blood test every year because it only costs you $50 a year. So that's kind of the premise of what we do. And I want to give you a different example, which is a, so the earlier example was about a diagnostic test. And this time I want you to go a little bit upstream, going up the curve that you saw earlier, and talk about some prognosis scenario. And here we have a program that's based on COPD. I don't know how many people have heard of COPD. So it stands for chronic obstructive pulmonary diseases. Over 1.4 million Canadians have this condition, and in the US, about 15 million Americans have COPD. So one of the problems for COPD patients when it comes to management is that from time to time, they have what is called lung attacks. So they have this episodes where the lung shut down very, very quickly. And as you know, if you cannot breathe for more than, you know, 30 seconds, a minute, you will die. So a lot of this, when the COPD patients is suffering from this kind of exacerbation, they need to go to the emergency room. And so it's very expensive, once again, and in fact, a lot of them, the average length of time that a COPD patient suffering from an exacerbation will need to stay in hospital will be like 3 weeks. So that add to the cost as well. And in fact, in some small percentage of them, they actually die in the hospital. So the goal is that, well, how do you don't, you want to be able to predict or prognose that, okay, maybe someone is undergoing an onset of a lung attack, try to give him or her some medication to feel a lot better, to kind of have a soft landing rather than crash like that when the lung actually shut down. So this is what we were trying to do with this test. And so this is another cartoon, because right now there's really no way of doing it. So what I'm showing here is that the let's just use the red patient as the high risk case and the blue patients as the low risk case. Right now, it's just based on the clinical judgment of the physician to predict who is going to have a severe exacerbation or a mild exacerbation, and there's a lot of misprediction just based on clinical judgment. So in this case here, what this really show is that if the blue person, if the low risk person get overdiagnosed, then the patient got overtreated with all kinds of steroids, which is obviously very bad side effects for the patient. You have the reverse problem in the case that when you have a high risk patient who got underdiagnosed as mild, then the patient got undertreated, and this is a patient that for sure is going to end up in hospital. And so the idea then is that if our prognostic blood test happens to be perfect, we will have the right diagnosis, the blue have the appropriate medication, and the red have the steroids to help them. So this is a program that we started in 2014, and we have funding to last till 2018. And again, the timeline is that hopefully some point within the next 3 years, we'll be able to get the data to the FDA. So this really finishes the first part of my talk, because I just want to give, when we're talking about biomarker development, personalized medicine, I just want to give a little bit of context in terms of the kinds of personalized medicine work that we do from the point of view of providing. So I hope I have made a case to you in the past 15 minutes just saying that there's a lot of opportunities trying to do better medicine, better care for the patient, and at the same time, it could be much cheaper because you want to catch all these cases earlier so that it's more effective and it becomes a lot cheaper. Now, I'm going to transit into the remaining parts of the talk, where I'm going to now bring some connections with what has that to do with data mining, machine learning, data science in general. And I would also speak a little bit about what are some of the key technical challenges. So now I'm going back to data science, computer science, and show you some of the things that we have been working on, and in terms of trying to help with this biomarker discovery program. But I think to connect to the data science, I think I want to show you one slide that really, I think many of you probably have seen this slide appearing in all kinds of contexts before. And I want to talk about, just the mega trends in our society for the past 20, 30 years. And what I'm showing in this graph is, the past 25 years. And then this is the cost from the point of, in log scale. And the orange line is the Moore's law. It's just talking about how rapid, transistors have advanced. For a lot of people in the audience who might not equally familiar with genomic technologies, broadly defined, is the blue curve, which shows the cost of sequencing. And it's really amazing how, the first time to sequence, it took 13 years, it cost $3,000 million. And now it's $1,000. And in fact, actually just today, I got a flash saying that in some of the major medical conference in San Francisco, they were talking about $100 personalized genomic sequences. But it's just telling you that this is really amazing in terms of sequencing. Now, I'm just using this graph, even though I'm just showing sequencing costs, but there's really a lot of biotech platforms that are advancing so amazingly in the past 25 years, proteomics, metabolomics, some of the things that you have heard of. And whereas, you know, in the computer science side, in the information technology side, as we all know, we have made a lot of advances in all kinds of things: CPU, storage, data capture, search, cloud, Hadoop, algorithmic, you know, machine learning, deep learning, all kinds of things. So from my perspective, I thought that, you know, the kind of things that I've been doing in the past 20 years are really exciting, because I'm just kind of sitting. I mean, it's like I'm standing at the confluence of two raging rivers where, you know, the information tech is advancing so fast and equally well on the biotech side. So with that, I want to say that, okay, so what really is biomarker discovery? Well, if you want to frame it to a very simple computer science problem, well, we are just building a classifier. We're just building predictive models. And in a diagnostic case, we are just, you know, you're just building a classifier. Embedded in it is that there's a huge amount of feature selection that you are really doing, because, you know, there are, nobody really know how many human genes, you know, there are. It's expected to be somewhere between 20,000 to maybe 25,000. And there are more than a million human proteins in the blood. So if I'm going to build a blood test of, let's say, based on a single digit of proteins, well, I'm really trying to, the feature selection that I'm doing is from a million to 10. And so this is a massive exercise when it comes to identifying the right proteins or the right gene transcripts in the blood. And so as it turns out, the challenges presented by the COPD data, as well as some of the similar genomic analysis, is the fact that it's actually very different from a lot of the techniques that have been motivated by business applications, where in business applications, the number of samples is typically much bigger than the number of features, P. But in the genomics case, is the reverse. The number of features that we are dealing with easily would be in, if not millions, would easily be in tens of millions, hundreds of millions. The number of samples, for various reasons, the number of samples in a lot of these genomic studies will be in the hundreds. If you have a study that's in 1,000, that is a big study, and that's typically cost about $10 million. So there's not too many of those cases where the N is 1,000 and or higher. And so that's one of the key differences when it comes to, you know, building the classifier or doing the feature selection. This is why feature selection is really very important in this problem. What is the most important, I think, is the fact that, for those of you who are familiar with biology, is that, you know, human biology is really very complex. So the messenger RNA, the microRNA, protein, DNA, and then all kinds of what is called epigenomics, they talk to each other in a sense. So we, even though the sample size may be small, but one of the things that's really interesting in genomics analysis is how you could integrate the signals from these multiple sources of data. I mean, people call this multiple compartments within the human body. Want to integrate all the signals so that you build a stronger hypothesis about what you're dealing with. So actually for this, I'm going to talk a little bit about this problem of integrating, trying to build this classifier by integrating from signals from multiple sources. And I want to talk a little bit about the bigger picture research from the point of view of I'm a computer scientist by my training. I'm not a biologist, so I look at this as a simple input-output model. That, you know, this is, the data is my input. I feed the data in. I have the CPU that crunch and, you know, build a model. And then somehow I need to output it. Someone needs to interpret the results, and maybe I need to get more data. This is a typical data science, workflow, your loop that we do. And so So let me first start off by talking about some of the key challenges that we are working on in terms of modeling, in the modeling component of this framework. Biology is really complex. So biology is really very complex, and in order for us to be able to have any chance to build good blood tests, robust predictive model from the data, we really need to be able to integrate from multiple compartments, signals from multiple compartments. But it's also very important because it's so complex to be able to do that longitudinally, to have longitudinal data. So the multiple time points is, I think, some of the things that is really critical when it comes to having a chance to deal with that complexity. So the multiple time points, and again, it come back into the form of, just like some of the curves that I showed you earlier, it comes back into showing how, allow us to build models about how the disease initiate, how the disease progress, and how do different types of cells starting to appear in the body. You know, maybe there's cancer cells that start to come. And so all of this is in the context of longitudinal changes. But in order to capture that, well, you probably need to have longitudinal data, because otherwise it's very difficult. And so we want to also be able to have a better understanding of, so it's not just about the genes. The genes interact with the environment. So in this context, when I use the term environment, I don't just mean it environment as in climate. Environment here means what we eat, what drugs we use, what kind of drinks that we have, what kind of air that we breathe into. So it's the genes, the gene interaction and the environment. And one of the things that is very popular in the past 10 years in this line of work is what is called systems biology, for those of you who have not heard of this term. And so we are trying to build very complex models, networks of genes and proteins, and try to build models about how the genes and may actually interact with each other to cause a certain thing. So the diagram,
Are you going to talk about how you, for your classifier, how you're going to collect the training data for, say, for the biomarker discovery classifier?
Yeah, so so if you take the COPD as an example, and if you take what I said earlier about multiple time points, we have a cohort in Vancouver, which are basically people who would, they have COPD, and they go to, they have regular checkup going to St. Paul's Hospital. And sometimes they also go to hospital because they think they have an exacerbation. So every time when they go to the hospital, we collect a tube of blood. So this is a prospective cohort. And obviously, a lot of people may not sign up, but there's also people who will sign up. So that's prospective. Also, for our COPD, we were using a very well-curated, well-phenotype data set created by GSK, GlaxoSmithKline, 5 years ago. And this is, they collect blood, they collect all kinds of things from 2,000 patients. And since we were talking about money, GSK spends about $20 million on this data set. So that tells you how, but that is a retrospective cohort that we also get some samples from GSK, as well as our Vancouver longitudinal cohort. But is a good question. One of the reasons why some of these genomic studies may not have a large enough N is the fact that depending on what the conditions are and depending on what time points you want to collect, there might not be a lot of availability. People might not sign up, people might skip, and when you're dealing with people, things happen. And so I hope I answered that. So let me continue. This is a slide that if you haven't seen this, you know, before, that when people talk about genomics, they could be talking about different compartments. It might be at the level of the DNA. It might be at the level of the transcript, the RNA, and then it might be at the protein level. And then there's also this level that's called metabolomics, which is so this is the metabolites are the end products of the metabolics of metabolism. And so this is particularly useful when you were, as we were talking about earlier, about drug interaction, because if a patient has taken some drugs, and depending on how he or she responds to the drug, you will be able to see that by measuring some of the metabolites. And so so the one of the things that, as I was saying, is that, well, how do you use different types of omics data to infer biological network modules? So what are these network modules? Well, these are groups of genes and proteins that work in a coordinated fashion. Now, it turns out that it's really complex when it comes to the genes working together. The typical notion of correlation, as we know, Pearman, Spearman correlation as defined in classical statistics, is really very rigid when it comes to the different forms of coordination that happens in genes. And so one of the, for those people in the field, won't be surprised that one of the most popular method that comes about in the past less than 10 years or so is this idea that's called WGCNA, weighted gene co-expression network analysis, and where they are trying to find out hub genes in a way that we are looking at, the internet, how web pages are connected to each other. And so the WGCNA has been applied, and this is trying to find all these groups of genes that work together, groups of proteins that work together in a coordinated way. And so one of the first question, and this is something that we have done, and we just recently published. This is somewhat a kind of a busy slide, and I apologize for that, is that one of the questions that you want to ask before you even dig into understanding what a gene module does is to just really understand, are this module reproducible? I mean, how stable? Okay, you put some data in and the method creates some sets of genes for you, and the basic question is that, well, maybe we should do a sensitivity analysis on how stable this kind of modules are. So what I'm describing here is a paper that we recently published. We were just essentially, from the original data, you create different kinds of modules, and we are just using a bootstrap strategy, trying to evaluate how stable a module is if we take out some of the samples. And what we ended up defining is a very simple score that we call the Hirsch index. In a way, is like H index for researchers' publications. We want to identify the highest threshold for which a module, you could find modules that have at least certain amount of overlap, even when you use a subset of the data. So this is a very recent publications that we have. The idea here is just, even from a statistical sense, trying to understand how strong, when we see a module of genes, before we spend time looking at its properties, we need to know, statistically whether a certain module is in fact stable. Now, assuming that now we have modules that we feel comfortable with, so one of the things that we would like to do is, for example, try to understand whether there is some regulation that goes on, because in the human body, genes regulate each other. So we want to reconstruct the regulatory network. And in this case, we are trying to also, this is an example of a model that we build taking into account of a lot of public data. And so here we take into account of protein-protein interaction data. We take into account of, you know, ever improving sequence motif data, and then we try to integrate our own gene expression data to try to identify infer transcription factors. So transcription factors, for those who might not be familiar with this term, are the types of genes that actually trigger the onset of a lot of activity. So these are the kind of like the triggering genes. This is why it's very useful to try to understand what started the process, what started a cascade of gene activity. So this is why in inferring transcription factor is of a lot of interest in the field. And so what I'm going to show you in the next slide, to go back to the COPD data that to go back to the COPD scenario that I mentioned to you, is to use 80 COPD samples from people suffering from lung attack versus people who have recovered. And so this is just to show you that this is the kind of diagram that we at least the kind of model that we try to infer from our data, is that we start to realize that there is a whole bunch of transcription factors, not only themselves cause a cascade of activity, they actually mutually affect each other. So for example, there's one gene here, I think for some of you who might be familiar with breast cancer, the BRCA1 or the BRCA family of genes is strongly associated with breast and ovarian cancer. And this is just showing that these transcription factors genes are triggering each other in a certain way when it comes to the COPD acute exacerbation. And the different color is just showing that sometimes they are upregulated in the people with exacerbation, sometimes they are downregulated. So what I'm trying to show here is that there are, by using your own data as well as integrating data from protein-protein interaction sequence motif data, now you could build hypotheses about how some of these transcription factors are very much involved in the onset of exacerbation. Okay? So let me now go to the next one. I think I gave you an example about modeling. Let me now talk about, well, what about the data? I think the data is very important too. Somehow, when the whole society is getting so excited about, you know, machine learning and what deep learning could do, I think there's an assumption that, well, you have all the right data in the world. And for those of you who are really involved in doing this kind of work, you know that getting the right data is not a foregone conclusion. It's actually a lot of the work. And in fact, you know, you could have all the fancy modeling capability that you have, but if you don't have the right data, it's just going to be garbage in, garbage out. And this actually links back to the one of the earlier things that I said about the mega trend, the biotech meet the infotech. In a biotech field, it's really exciting that they, you know, every few months, you know that they have a new kind of breakthrough. Now they are doing, you know, single cell sequencing, and you know they're measuring all kinds of things. And people in the field are really excited. But what they don't know is that, well, you know, those data that you get out from all those new devices is not like they could just be interpreted without a better understanding of errors, systematic noise, or even making one type of device data to be comparable with a different type of devices, you know, data. If the gene count is 17, from device A, it says 17, device B, it says 17, well, it's not the same 17. I mean, they might mean different things. Even if they are in the same unit, you might still need to do a lot of you know, normalization and things like that. So, you know, so it's very important that we need to be able to understand the data even before we start talking about modeling. And it's not only about the devices. For those of you who are familiar with clinical data, or you may come into contact with, you know, EML, electronic, you know, medical record data, you know that on top of that is that clinical data are very messy. There's a lot of missing values, there's a lot of outliers. And so you need to be able to handle all that. You need to be able to cleanse all that before you even start thinking about the modeling. So I want to show you an example. This is a this is based on what is called copy number analysis. This is on the DNA because humans are considered classified to be diploid, meaning that for each gene, if the gene is normal, we should have two copies of each gene. And what this device does is to allow us to see across the DNA, across the chromosome, allow us to measure how many copies we have for that region of the chromosome. Now, as you could tell, so this is actually a curated curated copy number result by a cytogeneticist. So this is an expert, and the black means that this is normal. It means two, and the yellow corresponds to a loss in copies, and the blue corresponds to a gain in copies. Now they're very interested in understanding this because imagine that if you have a tumor suppressive genes, and you lose a copy of that tumor suppressive gene, that would tend to imply that you might be more susceptible to tumors. You could obviously make the flip example when you say that, you know, when you have gained copies on genes that may be associated with tumor initiation, that is not good news either. So they are very interested in understanding copy number gain, copy number loss. And in addition, so you notice that even though I said that the number should be two, well, you look at all the black dots. Well, the device is not giving you a strict line which says two. The device is giving you all this correct signal that have a range. So even the correct signals are very noisy. And you can also see that there's some spatial dependency that is between the different areas of the chromosome that we measure. And then there are also some outliers depicted by the light blue dots, which is sometimes it is errors from the system. Sometimes it's actually not errors. So in the human body, there is such a thing as called copy number polymorphism. So these are well-known areas of the chromosome where we might actually have more than two copies or have fewer than two. And that is just normal. So what we ended up doing is that before we published our work, this was actually work that we have done 10 years ago, was that people were using various techniques like sliding window and so on. So but what we did was that we used a hidden Markov model to capture to really process the data. And then we also use a Gaussian mixture model to model the outliers separated from the inliers. And then the outliers have no spatial dependency, but the inliers have controlling by the hidden Markov model. We also use some prior knowledge to capture the known copy number polymorphism. And what we end up doing was a model that was a lot more successful. So this is, again, this is the gold standard that you saw earlier. This is our end results that our model call, and so we correctly call the yellow area, correctly call the blue area. We made some mistakes on a few things, but compared with existing techniques at the time, we were a lot more successful. Now this was 10 years ago. Now I think some of the tools that we have developed have actually entered into clinical use. So that also shows you that it takes a long time before, I mean, in this domain, it takes a long time before things could be moved into the clinic. So some of the key challenges that we have been working on is that I think there's really a lot of open problems when it comes to how we effectively do QA QC on unproven new biotech platforms, whether it's sequencing, whether it's other omics, because it's advancing very quickly. It actually speaks to the fact that before we could really trust the data, before we could even crunch the data, it's important for us to understand the data quality. And there is now also a lot of devices that are, you know, based on apps, based on variables. And it is important to make sure that, you need to be able to process, so there's no assumption that the number that you get today, the number 17 that you get today, is the same number 17 that you got 6 months ago, because it might not be 17. So, you know, so there's a lot of issues when it comes to data quality and also provenance. There's also something that I didn't talk about that I think is also important. In order to integrate the data, to deal with data from multiple sources, is important, I think, to also think about issues such as ontologies, curation. Some of the semantic web, I think, will be very useful too when it comes to integrating from multiple sources, particularly if the sources are autonomous. So I'm now getting to the last box, and I want to talk a little bit about interpretation. So in this domain, you know, we are computer scientists, we build all these tools, we build all these models. At the end, is a critical step to make sure that the domain expert, the real expert in the field, genomics, people who do COPD, people who do transplantation, they evaluate the model, they evaluate the data so that they know, well, what is really the hypothesis that I'm going to follow through? Should I get additional data? Should I do some, you know, gene knockout experiment to verify whether one transcription factor is triggering the other, or maybe should I participate in a clinical trial? So there's a lot of decisions to be made, and in order to make that decision, they need to really trust the model or maybe even trust the data. And so this is why interpretation is important. And helping the domain experts to really interpret the data. And I'm going to speak to a particular style of in interpretation beyond the normal way of, oh, we are going to use visualization tools. Visualization tool is obviously very, very important in this context. But I'm going to speak to how, in fact, text mining could be a very important piece when it comes to interpreting the model and the result for biomarker development. How does gene A interact with gene B? What do we know about this interaction in the literature? And what do other scientists think? I mean, are there, PNAS, for example, I think I've actually starting to have discussion forums for scientists so that they could actually discuss the results. And, you know, people have wrote blogs about scientific, about the science. And so that's also part of that interpretation, which links me into wanting to talk a little bit about how text mining, in fact, has a really critical role in this line of work. And so you might want to say, well, why do people interested in extracting information from text, particularly, let's say that I'm talking about extracting from PubMed articles? Because we are using a lot of these whole genome technologies, they often come up with all these genes that nobody has heard of. I have talked to multiple very senior biomedical researchers, and I asked them, well, what is the number of human genes that you think we know a good deal? And the highest number that I got is 3,000. So let's just say that we have 20,000 human genes. Well, we only know 15% of, we really know something about 15% of our human gene. The other 85%, we have a name. We might have one publication in the past 10 years on that gene, and that's all you have. So, you know, this is why I want to use the word reassurance, because, you know, if we are going to do the kind of tests, the blood tests, like the transplantation test that I told you about, where we spend over $10 million over 10 years, a lot of money, a lot of time, well, we are not going to do that unless we have some security that, well, we are really looking at the right genes, we are really looking at the right proteins, and this is not a false positive. And so this is why there's a lot of work that we goes into in terms of trying to extract out what, for a given gene, what do we know about that gene. So there's a particular style of, you know, text mining that I want to very briefly talk about in two or three slides. This is work that we have been doing now for a few years. And this is called rhetorical analysis. So rhetoric is about argumentation. There's an argumentation structure. So what we want to do is to understand the rhetorical relation, which is a description of how two segments of the text are rhetorically, are argumentatively connected to one another. I'll give you an example very, very quickly. And what we want to do is to create what is called a rhetorical parse tree about how two pieces of text are connected to each other and what role are they interacting with each other. So this is called rhetorical parsing. And I'm going to use examples is within a single sentence, intersentential, and an example across multiple sentences is called intersentential. Let me first use an example in the same context of, you know, protein. So this might be a sentence in a PubMed article. And suppose we find this protein, APOC3, and we come across this, you know, sentence: absence of APOC3, the natural LPL inhibitor, enhanced fatty acid uptake from plasma triglycerides in adipose tissues, which leads to higher susceptibility of diet-induced obesity, followed by more severe development of insulin resistance. Suppose the relationship that we are interested in is that, do we know from this PubMed article whether APOC3 is linked to obesity? Suppose we are interested in a simple relationship like this. Well, you need to be able to pass this sentence, which is not the easiest to pass, and really trying to understand, okay, is APOC3 linked to obesity? Well, there's all kinds of words, right? There's absence of APOC3. There is higher susceptibility. Well, I mean, if we read it, we'll say yes, but, you know, it's not so easy to use a program to extract that kind of relationship. I'm going to use a simpler example to illustrate for you a rhetorical parse tree. So suppose I have a sentence: the bank was hamstrung in its efforts to face the challenges of a changing market by links to the government. Analysts say the parse tree that you ended up, you know, getting is understanding that this one sentence is broken up into three parts, which is called EDUs, elementary discourse units, and so this I call EDUs, and then linking each of the EDU is a rhetorical relation. Like in here is saying that this is the main part of the sentence. The second piece is an elaboration of the first one. The bank was hamstrung in his effort, and it's just illustrating, well, hamstrung in his efforts to do what? Well, to face the challenges of a changing market. And then this relationship is called an attribution. This is attributed to what this analyst say. So we build this rhetorical parse tree, and it also gives you the idea of that, you know, so these are the relations, and then we know that, okay, this is really is the nucleus of the sentence. The satellite is just kind of secondary to the nucleus. So this is an intrasentential example. And so the computational task of rhetorical parsing is to be able to take this text and be able to segment this into different pieces and then be able to come up with, assume it's already segmented. So in discourse parsing, you want to come up with the structure of the connection, and then you also want to link up the label. So this is an example of, suppose I have three elementary discourse units in my one sentence, E1, E2, and E3. There are two possible binary structure, maybe link up E2, E3 first, or E1, E2 first. Suppose in this example, we determine that is really the first structure, then the second part of the parsing is to give a label. It says that, well, E2 and E3 are related in this way by relation 2, 3, and then they combine are related to E1 by this kind of relation. So in the sentence parsing model, just to give a little bit of a, this is a one slide description of how we could do that before we published this paper about 5 years ago, you would do structure determination and labeling separately. Now we have a joint model that will allow you to do structure and label at the same time. And we were setting this up as a conditional random field where these are the words in the sentences or the EDUs, and then we are going to put a structure, put a label, and we are going to learn this as a conditional random field, and we try to learn that together. Now, we have since, the example that I've shown you earlier was about a single sentence, and this is an example that says that we have extended that work so that now we could deal with multiple sentences and come in with intersentential parse tree. It turns out that to do intersentential parse tree in exactly the same way of intrasentential parse tree, the complexity is really high. And so we were using some heuristics to take advantage of the intrasentential parse tree and try to piece them together in various ways. So I think I'm done. I think I'm on time. That I, you know, in the first one third of my talk, I was trying to give you some examples of biomarker discovery and arguing that it could provide better care for the patients, better medicine, also at a higher, at a much lower healthcare cost, either to the system or, you know, even if it's private care, is certainly lower cost from the point of view of the patients. Certainly very high economic and societal value for this kind of work. I think I've convinced you that, you know, the general area of data science has a lot of to offer to biomarker discovery, but I think I've also shown you that biomarker discovery also presents a lot of open research problems for data science. I talk about modeling data and the interpretation component, and that I was using on the modeling, I was talking about integrating multi-omics data is a big open research field. A lot of people are doing this work, and I think this is an area that is going to last for at least another, you know, 20 years, and is getting more and more data, getting more and more complex. Talk a little bit about the importance of data quality, and I think this area is also not going to go away simply because there's, every month there are some fascinating new biotech platform that comes to the market. And, you know, just being able to deal with that data is a constant source of open research problem. And finally, in the context of interpretation, I was just picking a very specific scenario where I think that information extraction and other forms of text mining is in fact very important for supporting understanding, you know, the genes, understanding the biomarkers. And so that is also has a major role to play. So lots of people contributing to all this kind of work over the years, and I think I'm going to stop here. So thank you.
So I've just out of curiosity, this is way out of my field, but the one thing you mentioned is the role of that information extraction from text has in supporting the sparsity of training examples that you had before. Now, when you do when you use one technique to complement each other, are there any algorithmic techniques that actually combine these two, or is it sort of something where you look for candidates generated on one side and then for supporting evidence extracted from medical documents?
Wow. Okay. So that's a very good question that you have asked. So we have seen cases where if I have a blood test that's just based on the gene expression, the performance of this test could be enhanced by another test that's based on proteins. So there's this certain degree of this, what is called combinatorial biomarker panel, that in fact the signal from transcriptomics add to the signals from proteomics. So one form of the work is to do the biomarker discovery on both compartments, and then you have some way of combining that signal to give you a better performance. So this is one line of work. The information extraction side, the example that I show you about the transcription factor, corresponds to the second scenario where I am just using, I get my genomics data, I get my proteomics data, and for the genes and for the proteins that I'm interested in, I'm just trying to understand whether they biologically make sense or not, or whether we know that, we already know that people have worked on how this set of genes and this set of proteins are connected with each other. So that, in that second exercise, we were just looking for knowledge or hypothesis or, you know, what is known in the literature. Let us just not say that whatever is in the literature is actually correct, but at least what is known in the literature is this. So I think we do both of them. I mean, sometimes we just use them as features to build model. Sometimes we go after what we know in the literature in terms of knowledge, and we try to build a hypothesis and say, well, if I look at this, if this group of genes and this set of proteins are really connecting like that, maybe I should design a wet lab experiment on this gene because it trigger them in a certain way. Well, then you might design a mouse model to try to study it, and if you see it, then you say, ha, good. I think they serve different purposes, but I mean, both are very useful.
For the biomarker discovery, how do you do the, you said that the feature engineering, you use the proteins, and how do you do the feature engineering, and what kind of accuracy numbers do you have? Because you said that it can soon be used for actual clinical situations.
Well, so this is a very big discussion topic that I don't know, whether you know, but some of the typical biomarkers that are in clinical use, you know, people talk about measuring cholesterol, predicting certain cardiovascular conditions. The AUC, I mean, if you're talking about performance, you would say, well, what is the area under the ROC curve? If you have a marker in a conventional context, if you get a marker that probably give you in a 0.6 range, you're using it. So in a way, the biomarker tests that we are often looking for, if we get to a 0.8, then we are talking. You rarely see something that is 0.9. Now, that I should be careful. I should elaborate on my last statement. It depends on what the source is. Tissue is a lot more accurate, right? If you are doing a diagnosis on getting a piece out of your heart, out of your kidney, the signal is strong, and so you might get a much higher AUC, even though biopsy sometimes is, you know, random. I mean, you just, you know, you have a big organ here, particularly in the case of a lung. A lung is a huge organ. in the body, and you're just getting a tiny piece out, and you say, well, do I have exacerbation or not? Well, maybe you are just unlucky. You get the wrong part of the lung, and maybe you don't see anything. So it's not like tissue doesn't have problem, but the tissue signals are much stronger. Blood is everything, right? Everything flows into the blood. And so that is why the signals in the blood are oftentimes weak. And this is why it's not so easy to actually get a ROC that would be above 0.8. But in terms of just comparing with what we use in the clinic, you would that's kind of the range that we are looking at. Now, and then as you know, in medicine, there are different things that you play with too. It's not just the area under the ROC curve. Sometimes you might want to optimize, there might be different costs in minimizing false negative versus false positive. Because sometimes you might want to be, maybe a false positive is better than a false negative, and so you could change your threshold in a certain way, or sometimes it's the opposite. And so it depends on what, FDA called this the fit for purpose. It depends on what your purpose is. Then you might want, so even your ROC curve is the same AUC, but depending on which part in the curve you might pick, you might want to use it for different, slightly different purposes. So that's a big subject in the diagnostic field. So.
Okay.
Good. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay.